And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Tim Baker, the author of a new book called Patting the Shark. Tim is the best-selling author of a number of surfing books, Busting Down the Door, Surf for Your Life with Mick Fanning, Century of Surf. He is a former editor of Tracks and Surfing Life magazines. He has twice won the Surfing Australia Hall of Fame Culture Award and been nominated for the CUB Australian Sports Writing Awards. His work has appeared in Rolling Stone, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian Way, The Surfer's Journal, Qantas and Playboy, as well as surfing magazines around the world. Tim, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks. And look, when we read your book, and in fact the subtitle is A Surfer's Journey, Learning to Live Well with Cancer. So I guess my first question is, how are you feeling today?
Yeah, really well. Had a surf this morning, fresh back from a trip to Bali. To the Ubud Riders Festival and a bit of surfing over there too. So, yeah, look, 7.5 years after a pretty grim diagnosis, seem to be holding up all right. So, yeah, I'm pretty stoked, to be honest.
That's the great news. And, look, the title of your book, Patting the Shark, it's a bit unusual. Most of us are never going to get into that position where we're able to pat a shark. And I suppose the first thing you might think of rather than patting the shark might be punching the shark. But what's the story behind the title?
That's funny because the working title originally was Punching the Shark. And it was inspired by my my old mate Mick Fanning, three-time world surfing champion, who, as you mentioned earlier, I wrote a book with some years ago. And when I was diagnosed with what was metastatic stage 4 prostate cancer in July 2015. About 12 days later, Mick Fanning had his famous run-in with a great white pointer shark at Jeffreys Bay in South Africa. And I think, you know, lots of us have seen that footage of him sitting out in the water during a pro surfing final and this big dorsal fin appearing next to him. And as I watched that footage, I kind of felt like I was going through a kind of slow motion version of what Mick was dealing with, you know, this mortal threat suddenly kind of appearing and you know, you very quickly got to work out how to respond. And, you know, Mick's response was famously to punch the shark. And then in the footage, you see him swimming towards the beach and then stopping and turning back towards the horizon out to sea to kind of face the shark. And Mick's a pretty inspiring figure and I took a lot of inspiration from that. But as time went on, I felt like, you know, fighting off this mortal threat of mine wasn't really sustainable and I somehow needed to make my peace with it. And so I came up with the phrase patting the shark, which is really a metaphor for, you know, making peace with our mortality, I guess. And then I'd no sooner kind of had this thought than I found myself scrolling Instagram, as you do, and there was a post from Mick working on a documentary with National Geographic, Diving with Sharks, with a conservationist who is dubbed the Shark Whisperer, and he was literally patting sharks. So I sort of took that as a bit of cosmic confirmation that I was on the right path, and that sort of became a bit of a mantra of mine to sort of make peace with my diagnosis.
Yeah, well, you certainly were confronted. You mentioned then how you were diagnosed with stage 4. I understand there is no stage 5, so...
Yeah, exactly, as one fairly insensitive oncologist told a patient who I've been in touch with, he said stage 5 is the Tobin brothers for being the funeral directors.
No.
So, yeah, stage 4 is not good news, but I guess I've learned along the way that there's lots I can do in tandem and consultation with my sort of medical team to support my own health through my own kind of lifestyle measures.
Well, we often hear, you know, when people talk about prostate cancer, very often people will say, oh, yes, but, you know, you don't die of it. It's you die with prostate cancer,
rather. Yeah, yeah.
But I think your experience would be that that's not always so optimistic. Is that right?
Well, no. I mean, I think improved screening means that most prostate cancer is detected at the localised stage, which is entirely treatable. So if the cancer's within the prostate can be removed through a surgery called a radical prostatectomy, which might have some ongoing sort of side effects in terms of incontinence and sexual function, but it is effectively, in most cases, a cure. When the cancer is spread beyond the prostate, then the picture changes dramatically. And once it's spread to the bone, which is what we call metastatic, you know, the prognosis is particularly dire and it is considered incurable and ultimately fatal. I think prostate has also often been sort of thought of as an old man's disease, and in a lot of cases, old men with localised prostate cancer will be advised just to adopt a sort of watch and wait or active surveillance strategy if it's a low-risk cancer. But I was particularly young to be diagnosed with advanced disease, and so, yeah, pretty aggressive treatment was the strong recommendation, really to extend life, but with no sort of promise of a cure.
Because I think, you were about 50 when you were first diagnosed?
Yeah, that's correct. I went for the sort of old post-turning 50 checkup, not expecting to find anything wrong with me. I was felt like I was a reasonably fit and healthy 50-year-old. I surfed regularly. I ate reasonably well. I wasn't a heavy drinker or a smoker. Nothing to suggest I had anything to worry about. I thought it was just a bit of a kind of a routine thing you did when you turned 50. And then, yeah, the news was not so good.
Did you have any indication at all that there was anything wrong?
There was just the more frequent trips to the toilet, you know, getting up during the night to pee, but I just kind of figured that's sort of what happens as you get older as a bloke, you know. And then I had had some pain in my right leg, which just sort of came and went over the course of a few days, and so I didn't think too much of it, but in hindsight, I had a large tumour in the right femur or thigh bone, and so that was the first indication that something was wrong there, and it was quite acute. It was the sort of pain that could sort of wake me up in my sleep, which is a, you know, a particular type of pain that doctors take note of. And so, yeah, that was the first indication that something serious was wrong.
Well, I think this is one of the main reasons you had for writing the book was perhaps the way the medical fraternity perhaps treated you from the beginning. Didn't seem to be a lot of empathy or sympathy or anything.
I was pretty shocked when I discovered what the frontline treatment for was for the condition. It's sort of euphemistically known as hormone therapy or androgen deprivation therapy. I guess the layperson's explanation is prostate cancer feeds on testosterone, and so the treatment is to block or suppress testosterone. And so there are some pretty obvious side effects to that. And having this news broken in a pretty abrupt, perfunctory way and then just told, we'll get you started on hormone therapy without much discussion of the side effects, really just kind of threw me into a tailspin. And once those side effects became apparent, I felt entirely unprepared for them, and, you know, really felt like I hadn't been given enough information, even really to give informed consent to the treatment. I think doctors worry that if they give a fuller explanation of how this is going to impact you, that men might balk at the treatment and then get themselves in more trouble when the disease progresses. But, you know, I think it's pretty important that men are given the information and the tools to sort of mitigate side effects and hopefully manage, you know, quality of life issues a bit more effectively.
So when you got the news, you were fortunate that you had your wife sitting next to you. But was that a worry too? I mean, how, you know, I guess the natural tendency is to focus on yourself, but then you had a wife and kids and a career and all sorts of mortgages, all sorts of other things that were weighing down on you. You know, did that make it worse or better, or how did he deal with it?
I mean, it's great to have that sort of family support, and there are statistics that say that men in relationships with prostate cancer tend to fare better than, you know, men who are on their own for fairly obvious reasons, you know, emotional support and just having that another person, that medical appointment, that second set of ears to help sort of process and retain information. But prostate cancer is often spoken of as a couple's disease because it affects so many elements of a relationship. I mean, you imagine when you block or suppress testosterone, that has pretty far-reaching impacts on a man. So, you know, things like loss of sexual function and libido, loss of muscle mass, loss of bone density, increased risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. You're four times more likely to commit suicide as a man on hormone therapy. And this is, I mean, this is the treatment. This is what they're trying to, this is what they're giving you to try and suppress and slow the spread of the cancer, but it has such far-reaching impacts. It really takes a toll on relationships and entire families. Men can become quite moody and withdrawn. You know, there's obvious impacts on relationship and intimacy. And, you know, men aren't great at talking about all this kind of stuff. And as all this became apparent to me, I just felt like it sort of needed to be dragged out into the open. And as uncomfortable as it was, I kind of felt like, as a journalist and a writer, it sort of fell to me to talk about the experience and hopefully shed some more light on it.
Yeah, well, I'd have to say you've been very candid in your book, and you go into a lot of personal details, which, you know, oftentimes you don't see. But I think I'd agree with you. I think it's really necessary if you're going to get that message out that you know, you take that reader right into your world, which is and as an excellent writer, that's it's got a real benefit.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, yeah, I guess I've been doing this a long time, and I know how to. Hopefully I had to connect with a readership or an audience, and I knew the things that were going to get people's attention, and I definitely wanted to advocate for change in the medical system and the way these things are treated. So as uncomfortable as it was, as I say, I just made a bit of a pact with myself that I had to be really candid, and if things felt uncomfortable, that I would just sort of write into the discomfort, and that was the way in which it was going to reach people and make a difference. And that seems to be the case. I've been really overwhelmed by the response, to be honest, not just from patients and their partners, but from the medical fraternity. I've had amazing feedback from oncologists and urologists. Yeah, it's been incredibly gratifying.
We're speaking today with Tim Baker, who's the author of a new book called Patting the Shark. And about this stage of the program, we usually ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song for the show. Tim, have you got a song for us?
Yeah, I absolutely do. It is pretty much my theme song. It's sort of a tune that I live by. It's called Every Day I Write the Book by a great favourite of mine, Elvis Costello. And, I mean, I literally do get up most days and write the book. It's what I do. So every time this song comes on, it really gives me a bit of a kick.
When you find strange hands.
And that was Every Day I Write the Book by Elvis Costello and The Attractions, as especially chosen for us today by our guest Tim Baker, who is the author of a new book called Patting the Shark. Tim, when people read the book, they might hear about another band, the Frothies. I wasn't sure whether we might get a quick song from them at some stage.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's quite appropriate for this kind of program. That was in my distant youth. It feels like a lifetime ago. That was 40. Sort of beer drinking anthems, but it was a bit of fun as a young bloke to, you know, we were gigging around the Gold Coast. I guess that was back in the late 90s, mid 90s. So yeah, quite a long time ago, but yeah, good fun. And I've recently realised my son and his mates have discovered some of these songs on Spotify. And that was an outcome I hadn't anticipated when I was performing them, you know, 25-30 years ago.
And were you were playing what, rhythm guitar, were you, in the band?
Yeah, guitar and vocals. As I say, it was a bit of a laugh. We didn't take ourselves too seriously, but yeah, we had a good time.
Well, now going back to the treatment, you mentioned about the hormone therapy. I guess you're particularly vulnerable when you're diagnosed, that you'd be prepared to do almost anything to look for a cure.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's really the message you're given, like that you have to submit to this treatment or you are literally going to die. I think, you know, without aggressive treatment, I was told maybe 18 months. With treatment, I could expect 5, maybe 6 years, and it's 7.5 years and counting, and I'm still in great health. So I was also annoyed, I think, that, you know, the message I was given that there wasn't much I could do for myself, really, that you kind of hand all power over to your doctors and, you know, they make the best decisions on your behalf. But I think it's really important for men to be proactive about their health. I mean, even prior to a diagnosis like this, you know, prevention's obviously better than cure. And, you know, catching the disease early is a whole lot better than an advanced diagnosis. So I really encourage men to, yeah, look after their health and also get checked out. The strong recommendation is to get tested for prostate cancer from the age of 50 pretty regularly. But yeah, there was a whole lot of things that I took a pretty, I think, fairly sensible, holistic middle path through the maze of mainstream and complementary therapies, and stuff like exercise and nutrition and meditation became real, really real pillars of my kind of self-care.
The message seems to me, it's not that you're trying to, displace medical advice or get the... You're encouraging getting the best medical advice, but what you're saying is doing something in addition to that, like getting your exercise and some of the other relaxing things that you've practiced over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, there is strong evidence, particularly for exercise. I mean, all those side effects of hormone therapy I mentioned, exercise is the sort of perfect antidote to most of them. And, I like to say if there was a drug that did for us what exercise does, you know, the doctors would be shouting it from the rooftops. It would be this incredible medical breakthrough. But, you know, something as simple as exercise that helps strengthen bone density, it improves muscle mass, it improves cardiovascular health, it can even, you know, elevate mood and help offset depression. And, you know, there's some suggestion it can even improve sexual function. So any man diagnosed with prostate cancer and prescribed hormone therapy, I believe, should absolutely be referred to an exercise physiologist for a sort of guided and prescribed sort of exercise program. And at the same time, I think referred to a nutritionist or dietitian, because there's pretty clear evidence to support a predominantly plant-based diet, and there are specific foods that are very good for helping manage prostate cancer. You know, leafy green vegetables, what they call cruciferous vegetables, really just eating lots of fresh fruit and veg, soy products, green tea. Yeah, these aren't sort of contentious issues, but I think the average oncologist, you know, isn't trained in nutrition, and so it really takes a multidisciplinary approach and a bit of a team to get around the person with the diagnosis and provide that multi-layered support.
You would also recommend for the calming effect, if nothing else, the use of medicinal cannabis. Is that starting to come in more, do you think?
Yeah, I'm actually on a clinical trial for medicinal cannabis for people with chronic illness, and it's really just measuring quality of life issues, so they're not attributing any particular sort of therapeutic or medicinal benefit, even though, you know, there is some evidence to suggest it may have an anti-cancer effect. You know, the common refrain from doctors is that the jury's still out on that. But I found medicinal cannabis really helpful for sleep predominantly, because as a man with prostate cancer, you tend to get up during the night multiple times, and having broken sleep is not great. And, you know, sleep is when we heal. And so having good quality sleep, again, is really important. And so if that was the only thing it did for me, is give me a good night's sleep, then that was enough of a benefit. And if there was any sort of anti-cancer or medicinal benefit, then that was kind of a bonus. And since going on the trial and speaking with a specialist medicinal cannabis doctor, you know, they do talk quite optimistically about a potential, what they call a non-proliferation effect. So, you know, no one's claiming it's a cure or it's going to replace conventional therapies, but it may have some benefit in just slowing progression. You know, that for me is a pretty exciting frontier, and there's ongoing research, which hopefully will, you know, yield some definitive results in the not-too-distant future.
You mentioned the hormone therapy and some of the effects. I mean, it works, I guess, by reducing the testosterone in your body, and that's one of the things that that can cause problems with prostate cancer. But I was interested to see, it's not all bad. There seem to be some good effects of losing testosterone.
Yeah, I mean, it's a curious thing. I mean, I think, you know, the net effect is overwhelmingly, you know, really debilitating. As one doctor said to me, you know, blokes are basically machines that run on testosterone, and so the absence of it can create, yeah, fatigue and lethargy and mood swings and depression. But yeah, I guess in the search for a silver lining, I did find that my hair grew back thicker after chemotherapy, and I've got a fine head of hair. Also, just feel a bit less aggressive, I think, in moments of stress or tension, and because testosterone is really something that fuels, you know, that male impulse to sort of protect or fight when faced with a threat. It can leave you feeling a little bit kind of vulnerable at times. But I also found, I think it improved the way I relate to women, because in the absence of a libido, you know, you just sort of realise how much men often just sort of assess women physically. And when that's taken away, you just sort of tend to relate more as just fellow humans and not have a sort of any issues around gender and that sort of thing. And so I found that quite a unexpected but, you know, quite pleasant outcome.
And so when you meet people in this situation, your situation you're in now, do you tell them early on that you've got cancer?
Oh, look, it varies considerably. It might, you know, it depends on the context. You know, sometimes it's nice to meet people socially and not go there and not have to be the guy with cancer. I'm not shy about talking about it if it comes up in conversation. And having written the book and having attracted quite a bit of media, I mean, a lot of people I meet already know, and you sort of feel at a little bit of a disadvantage, because if they've read the book, it's like, well, you know, the most personal details of my life, and I don't know anything about you. But yeah, I guess I made that decision in the hope of sort of helping people in a similar situation. But, you know, I was recently in Bali on holidays and surfing and having a good time, and I just didn't feel like bringing it up. It was nice to kind of step out of that world and not be that person for a while.
And when you tell people, if you do decide to tell them, what's the usual reaction?
Oh, look, it varies considerably. I think a lot of people find it really uncomfortable and aren't sure how to respond. I definitely had that response quite early on, where people feel confronted with their own mortality when they meet someone in a situation like mine, because the prognosis is so uncertain. And people like a sense of resolution or closure. So I found people would often default to a sort of a kind of optimistic assessment of my situation. They're like, oh, did they get it early? And I'm like, no, they didn't. That's why it's called advanced, you know. Yeah. And is all that behind you? How long have you been in remission? Because people see me and I look reasonably fit and healthy. And, you know, you have to sort of have that conversation. Well, this is ongoing. It's not something I'm going to just, you know, get to the end of and come out the other side with a clean bill of health. It's something I've got to manage and try and maintain health and fitness for as long as possible. And, you know, the hope is I remain healthy until better and more effective treatments become available. And, you know, I seem to be doing a reasonable job of that so far. But you definitely notice the range of responses in people, and sometimes it can make people quite uncomfortable.
I'm just, you know, looking at the number of things you've got involved in. I mean, you've been surfing in Bali, you've written the book, you've got a PhD scholarship. It sort of reminds me of that Bob Dylan line about he not busy being born is busy dying. And
yeah, absolutely.
And for that reason, yeah, we are very grateful with you being as busy as you are that you found time to come on Dad's on the Air, which it's a treat talking to you, Tim, and we just wish you all the best as you continue on this journey.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, one of my doctors actually said that soon you get busy living or get busy dying, and that's certainly been a big motivation for me. And, you know, I embarked on a PhD 5 years into a diagnosis with a 5-year prognosis. So, you know, that's probably the definition of optimism right there.
Yeah, I used to feel when I was working full time that if I ironed 5 shirts on a Sunday night, I was being optimistic. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So far, so good. So, yeah, thanks for your good wishes.
And unfortunately, we've run out of time today, but it's just been an absolute treat speaking with Tim Baker, the author of this new book, Patting the Shark. If you'd like to listen to this interview again, you can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to the show again or any of our shows, go to that website, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or your favourite podcast. So, it just remains for me now to give a special thank you. Tim, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Yeah, my pleasure, Bill. Thanks for your interest.
And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.